This is the state of things from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. Thank you. Thank you. In 1984, Republican Howard Coble won a seat in the U.S. House by narrowly defeating Democrat Robin Britt. Analysts said Coble rode the coattails of President Ronald Reagan. There was another close election in 1986, but after that, Howard Coble secured the seat with convincing wins in which he never got less than 60% of the vote. In four of those races, he didn't even face a Democratic challenger. Throughout his tenure, Congressman Coble has been a friend of the state's agricultural and textile industries. He has even occasionally spoken out against his own party and the aforementioned Ronald Reagan. In January, Congressman Howard Coble will return from Washington, retiring after more than three decades of public service. Congressman Howard Coble, welcome to the State of Things. So great to have you.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be with you. Thank you. Thank you, Frank. I appreciate that. Thank you all for being here today.
Your first two elections, pretty close.
Especially awfully. The second one.
79 votes, was that right?
79 votes, and I had, and Robin Britt, who was the incumbent Democrat, came by to visit us on an open house this past 2 days ago, well, about a week ago. So we were friends and continue to be good friends.
After that, though, and this district was one that used to go back and forth, right?
They called it the revolving door district.
But not after that second election. After 86, you had a secure hold on that. What do you think accounts for that?
Probably accessibility. Constituents are demanding more accessibility from elected officials than was the case, say, 20 years ago. And I think those demands are justified. I think constituents have every right to expect to see their elected officials frequently. I recall, Frank, having talked with a guy, oh, this has been 25 years ago, who was thinking about running for Congress. And he came to me for my, quote, counsel and advice. And during the conversation, he said to me, he said, I will say one thing at the outset. I will not ride in one damn parade. I said, well, sir, if I don't believe I would make that a campaign pledge. Because these towns, be they small or large, they're proud of their, particularly Christmas parades. So accessibility, I think, Frank.
You were one of those.
If I may, yeah. Coupled with a good staff.
Yeah.
A good, diligent, hardworking staff. If you don't have, I don't care how good you are as a congressman or elected official, if you don't have a good staff, you probably won't survive.
You are known as one of those old-style politicians. Not that you're old, but an old-style politician.
No, I plead guilty to both of
them. You know, you remember everybody's name. I saw you talking with people here, remembering their grandchildren and where they went to high school and meeting them. And you have a reputation for knowing people and remembering them four and five, having met them only once or twice. That's a kind of politician that we don't see much anymore. Would you say you're one of a dying breed?
Yeah, I am one of the dying breed.
I suppose we all do sooner or later. If you think about it, yeah.
And I told somebody that somebody said, "Well, Howard, you could have won re-election if you sought re-election." The makeup of the 6th district is now profoundly different than it was prior to the last election. I think maybe I could have won re-election, but I'm at the age of life now where I'm plagued with a bad back. And skin cancer. Hmm. And oftentimes constituents will say, well, I'm not sure he could do it physically. So I may have not been able to have done it. But we have now 10 counties as opposed to 6 before. And 8 of those 10 counties are new counties who are not known to me. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Ivan with Preservation Greensboro. Many of you today have commented on my coat. Well, Preservation Greensboro, with Ivan's help, Macy's department store, which violates my dad's employment with the Belk store for 32 years, but they nonetheless contributed this to the coat, and the mayor presented it to me, I mean, you will recall, and I've gotten more feedback on this coat thanks to Preservation Greensboro and Macy's.
So for those of you who can't see it, it is a checked jacket, a plaid jacket, black, gray. There's some yellow hints in there. It's a character filled jacket.
Thank you.
There's a lot. And I don't know that Macy's is going to be happy about knowing that you're not going to be on the cover of their magazine, but it's a beautiful jacket. You're known for your jackets. You've got a lot of classy jackets, right?
Yeah, but this emphasized it more profoundly.
It's great. Hey, how did you get into politics? What got you interested in this?
An old time with Guilford County attorney, the late N.D. McNary, Duke lawyer, but I forgave him for that long ago. He said, Howard, we will never be able to establish a two-party government in North Carolina if we don't get people involved willing to run for office. See, back in those days, folks, you youngsters won't recall this, but back in those days, the election was determined at the primary. If you prevailed in April or May, at one time it was in April back in those days, if you prevailed then as a Democrat, you were assured of being elected. Governor Holzhauser and I had the same conversation.
And he's a Republican. Just Pardon? To point that out. A Republican Governor Holzhauser.
Yeah, right. The first one this century,
That's
by
right.
the way.
Mm-hmm.
And we agreed that to establish a two-party government, you do need people on both sides nipping at each other's heels. Now, my mom and daddy were Democrats. I was reared in a Democrat home. But you reach across the aisle. Now, a lot of folks don't like that. Oh, no, it's just compromise is weak, they say. Well, I think compromise is probably a necessary element to getting things done. Always perfect, no. Rarely, if ever, perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, be flexible.
Reaching across the aisle is one of the hallmarks. The other is being able to stand up to your party when your party you felt was working against the interests of your district. A case in point would be the textile bill. That Ronald Reagan approved that would have hurt, in your mind, the textile industry, and you opposed Ronald Reagan in your first term as congressman.
Wasn't too smart, maybe. but back then, when I was elected in 1984, the bread and butter issues in our district were textiles, furniture, and tobacco. All three are beleaguered. Not ready to give up on them, Frank, but beleaguered as opposed to back then. Of course, there are some folks in the Congress who would like to put the final nail in the tobacco coffin. Well, I can't in good conscience do that because Lorillard is headquartered here in Greensboro, employ hundreds of employees. So that because it depends upon interpretation, I guess, in no small way.
Well, let me ask you about that one in particular, because in the textile industry, you have people working here. You can talk about the cost, where it's more efficient to produce and all of that. It becomes an economic question. In the case of tobacco, I'd love to talk with you about this. There's a public health issue involved here. It's the impact of tobacco smoking on individuals and therefore the cost of public health in general. And then you have a constituency who have jobs that depend on that industry. Do you see your role as sort of protecting their jobs? Because there's a third way, which would be to find ways out into other industries. And you could use your position as a member of Congress to help them into another industry without the public health implications. I mean, how do you see a question like that?
That's a good point. It's very delicate and very fragile. This is how you get that done. Mm-hmm. But your point is not foolish.
That's the first time I've ever heard that from a member of, and that's from a member of Congress. So I,
well, Frank, when you mentioned textiles, I'd be remiss. My mama was a textile worker. She sewed pockets on overalls for the old Bluebell down on South Elm Street. So I know the significance of a textile check coming into a family. As I said earlier, my dad worked with the Belk store here in town.
Well, there's other questions too about. Hewing to holding to the party line. You know, your opponent, Robin Britt, who you mentioned earlier, accused you of flip-flopping. He said when you were in the North Carolina legislature, you approved abortion funding, and then when you went to Washington, you opposed it on the national scale. Was that a matter of you having to toe the line a little bit as a party member?
Probably. Probably so.
Well, there is an example of honesty among a politician. I have just completely revised my whole definition of a politician based on what you just said. What about that? Now, as you look back, what do you consider your greatest accomplishments?
Greatest accomplishment?
Yeah.
Probably some of the textile and furniture votes that came down on the side of domestic production. Mm. Someone asked me what was my most disappointment. And you may come into this, Frank, before you, but upon my first election, I said that I would not participate in the congressional pension. That was not my most brilliant financial decision. but I felt that taxpayers pay my salary. I don't think you should be saddled with a plush congressional retirement fund. And it is indeed plush.
It's $138,000, $139,000 a year, something like that. Am I right? $138,000?
Well, I think plus? Probably $75,000.
Is that
salary,
it?
I think. My decision will cost me between $1.5 million and $2 million.
Bold decision. We will continue our conversation with Congressman Howard Coble, who is retiring in January. That conversation continues in a moment. But first, we're going to hear from Greensboro's Little Mountain, and you will hear them on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us.
I'm in it for the money, what the hell am I doing here? Another shot of bourbon, another glass of beer. Don't you think it's funny that life is all you got? It's like getting a ticket in your own damn parking lot. So I started thinking about what went wrong. Then I got to drinking and wrote this country song. Don't you think it's crazy that my life turned around? It happened on the day that my plumbing went down. I got roots in my pipes, I got shh on my floor. I went to see my baby, but my baby locked the door. And I can't help that the weather's getting cold. It's only the beginning and my story's getting old. Got a date with the cellmate if I drive my busted car. A friend of mine just told me I shouldn't take it far. It's just a broken taillight, it ain't.
This is the State of Things from the Upstage Cabaret, a triad stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio here today with Congressman Howard Coble, who is retiring from Congress after 30 years. You know, going into the break, we heard this band Little Mountain, young folks here right in Greensboro who play the kind of music I know you really like.
In fact, I requested a song, I stumped the Little Mountain folks. The Soldier's Joy, that... They'll learn it one day soon.
That's a Civil War song, isn't it?
Civil War song.
Neither one of us are that old.
No, I'm closer than you are.
Hey, but speaking of that kind of music, country music, bluegrass music, you were able to present Earl Scruggs with a Lifetime Achievement Award. What was that like for you?
Unbelievably favorable. The Grammys invited me to come to Hollywood to do that. And I'll always remember it. When I was sitting next to him, he said, "Thank you, man, for coming out here to do this." He was from the Cleveland County, Shelby. Mm-hmm. In fact, I guess the museum has already been dedicated, I think, to him.
I think so, yep, up and running.
He was reared in the Flint Hill section of Cleveland County, but for all practical purposes, Shelby, nearby. But what a musician, what a guy.
I know they have redistricted and redrawn the district that the 6th district now, so it's different. But in terms of the people you served in general over that 30 years, how had things changed, How have things changed here in this district, in this
area? Well, the makeup of the district, as you pointed out, first of all, we now have Surrey, Stokes, Rockingham, Caswell, Person, in toto, and portions of Durham, Orange, and... trying to think of the third
and Guilford, one. But even before the redistricting, I'm saying in the 30 years you were there serving that district before it was redrawn, how had things changed over the time, just in the period that you served?
Changed, but not profoundly because the district was intact, mm-hmm. and there were six counties, two in toto, four portions of the remainder. But not that much as you'd think. Now, probably changed more now with the new face of the 6th District.
People are, you know, there's this big debate about whether or not we should have term limits, whether or not anybody should serve 30 years in Congress. And the debate cuts both ways, that having professional politicians who understand how to play the game is probably better than allowing ideologues to pop up whatever the issue of the day is. On the other hand, allowing a greater turnover might serve democracy better. Where do you stand on that?
I voted in favor of term limits, but my heart wasn't in it because I think term limits now are available to the constituency. If they want to vote Coble out, they can vote him out. But most of the people would like the idea of term limits.
What about the fact that we see so many uncontested districts now with redistricting, and it's not just here in North Carolina, in other states as well? We're seeing uncontested elections. Is it really the case that people can turn out the people they don't like, or have we constructed the politics not down to the district level in a way that democracy is not working so well?
Frank, probably a combination of both, all of the above. Not to bail out, not to take the politician's way out, but probably portions of either argument I think are valid.
What about money? You know, a big debate over whether or not corporations should be treated as people when it comes to their influence in the political process.
The money part of politics is obscene, and I regret that. But we're stuck with it. It's going to end up being a freedom of speech argument, I think, and you're going to continue to have lucrative contributions. But in defense of PAC contributions, I've never have been hard on PACs. PACs offer, let's assume you work at Lorillard, for example, or a furniture company, or a textile company. You try to weigh the difference between this one and that one and can come out with something that may not be what you wanted, but it's a half loaf. And a half loaf beats no loaf every time.
The argument, though, is that PACs are transparent. We know where the money came from, and we know where it's going, and it goes to the candidates. But soft money that was allowed, particularly under Citizens United, where now money goes to issues and not candidates, and we don't know who gave the money. How do you feel about that?
I guess when I say that PACs are not offensive to me, it gives the employee of the textile company a chance to kick in $25 or $50, right. and the employee feels an obvious role, a tangible role that he can touch.
But you know, a lot of money is coming into the system, even more not through the PAC system, but through outside influence and outside money that can be spent not directly on the campaigns and isn't then regulated the way PAC money is, and that money is being spent on issues and appears to be having quite a bit of influence.
Well, I think it has a lot of influence, right. and that's the portion that I don't like, that I don't think is going to be corrected.
What about your party, the Republican Party now, some of the issues it faces, incomplete control? What about immigration, for instance? How do you think the Republican Party is going to navigate this question of immigration?
Well, we're going to have to navigate it in some way. Otherwise, we'll be shown the gate that leads to the road out of town, just like this past month. Immigration is an issue, folks, that Democrats and Republicans alike can and must assume some of the blame for the obvious delay that's occurred since the mid-'80s. It will be addressed, I am confident, in the early stages of the next session, which, of course, comes up in January.
Well, what should we do? What would that bill look like? If you got to write the bill and then sign it, what would it say?
I would emphasize the importance of a guest worker program without penalizing those who stood in line and done it correctly.
So what about the executive order that the president issued? I mean, he's done some of that. He's saying, look, you have to stand in line, but we have to recognize the people who are here. How do you feel about that?
I think the president overextended his reach.
Would you like to see Congress pass a bill that essentially did what the president did by executive authority?
Probably not.
So how does it look? Again, you know, we've got an economy that apparently requires the workers, the number of workers we have here who are not documented. Is it practical to think about sending them home? If it's not practical to send them home, both because of the enforcement trouble and also the impact on the economy, then how do we go about allowing those people to stay here, recognizing that laws have been broken?
Well, that's one feature of the immigration issue I think that can be addressed, because the guest worker program has pretty well worked pretty favorably, particularly tobacco farmers in this area. Well, not just tobacco farmers, agriculturists generally. And I think that to that end, I think that's doable. Part of the bill is doable, I think. But you're talking about 5 million people lined up, in some cases being given preferential treatment compared to those who have in fact stood very patiently by.
But all of that could be addressed in legislation, where you stand in line, where you would fall in line if we gave you a new status. I mean, that could all be written into the law, right?
And I think that will probably be at odds with the president's proposal.
So what about that polarization? That's the other issue. When these issues come up now, the Republicans are in control of both houses, but not the White House. And we hear more and more about the trouble that we believe we're in a polarized environment. It's harder to get things done. You've been there for 30 years. Has it changed since you were there?
Yes, it has, but not as profoundly as the media would have you believe. I don't mean to be point accusatory finger at the media. But I guess that's what I'm doing.
Get your finger out of my chest, yeah, Congressman.
Finger out of your eye.
It was ever thus, huh? It was always been this or it seems more polarized because it gives us all something
seems
to talk
more
about.
Polarized, but not as, some of my best friends up there are Democrats. In fact, I had a good constituent friend of mine. She said, someone told me that you like Steny Hoyer. Steny Hoyer, of course, for the benefit of you who may not know, is the Democrat whip, third in line in the Congress. I said, I regard Steny Hoyer as a very good friend of mine. She said, well, if you like Steny Hoyer, I guess I'll have to like him. I said, well, that's the kind of argument I like to engage in.
You'd win that every time. Again, the impact of money, I suppose, has some effect on this. But when you think about, again, how bills become law, I mean, even within the Republican Party now, some sense that there is a fracture within the party. The Tea Party wing of the party is creating problems for Republicans. Do you see it that way?
I think there is a fracture, yeah. A lot of folks don't like Boehner. Well, I think my dealings with Speaker Boehner have been favorable, not always to my approval, but he's a speaker and outranks me.
But how do you see the Republican Party addressing this split? I mean, certainly they did. Between 2010 and 2012, it seemed to torpedo the party in 2010. Far-right candidates who lost races that most people expected the Republicans to win. That didn't happen in 2012, so maybe the Republicans have fixed it?
Well, going back to what you said, if we don't fix it, we may be at the gate out of town. So our marching orders are laid out for us, it seems to be. And I think another change, Frank, involves the fact that we are now, as a practical matter, a two-party state. Two Republican senators, 12 Republican members of the House. I can recall when there was only one House member, Raper Jonas. From Lincoln County, only one Republican.
What do you say to those who will tell you that in the last two elections here in North Carolina, at the national level, more people voted for Democrats than Republicans, and yet if you look at the state legislature, it is overwhelmingly Republican, and so there's something about redistricting or something that makes this unrepresentative of the will of the people of North Carolina.
And Frank, I can't put a magic wand to that. I don't know. Fair statement, fair question, but I can't resolve it.
You listen. I want to talk to you about this. This is an amusing episode in your career. You met Michael Moore, the provocateur who once had a television show, right?
Yeah.
And he was going to do this. Michael Moore had this thing where he was going to prove that he could buy a vote, and so he went up to you, and I think he gave you a gift card. And he wanted you to introduce a bill that would create national TV week, I think it was. Maybe you can tell us the story.
I just vaguely remember it, Frank, so yeah. I can't add too much to that. But I remember meeting him.
Well, I remember it. So here's how it goes. So, Mike, you know Michael Moore. So he's got this stunt. He's got this TV show, and he's going to give the congressman a gift card. Congressman says, no, I can't take that. You have to go through a lobbyist. And they work out a deal, and it's in the hundreds of dollars. So we're not talking about a lot of money here, but it's hundreds of dollars. And you stood up on the floor and you made the argument that there should be National TV Week or something. And these gifts, I think, kind of changed hands. After that, you were asked about it, and here's what I remember you saying, or what the media, if you get your finger out of my eye, here's what the media, I believe they said, was that you said, well, there you go. And I was caught on the media, and they showed it for what it is, so kind of the system works, right? The system works.
Well, I'm drawing a complete blank on most of this.
Well, here's what I want to ask you about that, because Michael Moore is a provocateur. He can kind of make anything happen, and he did. So he jockeys this thing in which a representative gets up and calls for a day, you know, and I'm guessing it didn't pass, and perhaps you knew such a thing wouldn't pass, but if all I have to do is ask for it, I will. That's one thing. I want to ask you about the arguments, though, because this is interesting. The argument that you made was this will create jobs. If we have this National TV Week, it's going to create jobs. And I just wonder about this kind of rationalizing. And here's the part of the job of being a politician, where you may or may not, in a heartfelt way, agree with the legislation, but you've got to make a speech. And so then you start taking the arguments and crafting them in a way that's going to make your case. Look, let me ask you just bluntly, is that the downside of politics, having to make a case that maybe your heart's not really in?
Maybe, but it's the nature of the beast. We're not going to change that, I don't think.
What is some of the, tell us more about the highlights in your 30 years, things that you remember you've been to. Well, you talked about that politician who said he wasn't going to be in parades. I think you've been to, I don't know how many dozen parades you've been waiting.
Over 200.
Okay. What are some of the highlights for you?
Well, let me tell you a highlight that's unfavorable. I was reared in rural Guilford County, and I've always had problems embracing vehicular traffic. Some 4 or 5 years ago, I was being driven to the Washington airport by one of my staffers from rural Randolph County, which is more rural than Guilford County. And she's negotiated the Washington traffic much better than I have. But on this particular day, it was 95 degrees temperature, wall-to-wall traffic on the way to the airport. And I said to her, I said, I wouldn't live in this town. She said, you do live in this town, but you don't think of Washington as being home.
No, that's got to be the real reason. I don't know how you put up with it for 30 years. The traffic up there is enough to drive anybody out.
I've never adjusted to it. That's not the reason I'm leaving, but that could be.
Highlights legislation that you sponsored that you are particularly proud of?
Well, highlights events, 9/11. I spoke to a group from Rowan County Chamber of Commerce the night before the 9/11 attack, and they said, what should we be most concerned about in the next few years? And I said, well, terrorism would be one. Now, this was the day before 9/11. And the next day, I saw a guy from Salisbury. He said, the next time you say something, I'm going to listen to you. I have no idea why I picked terrorism. But that same morning, I was scheduled to speak to the Judicial Conference at the Supreme Court, and I left the Southern Pines Chamber of Commerce, or the Sandhills Chamber of Commerce, to go to the Supreme Court. As I was about to make my speech, Chief Justice Rehnquist handed me a note, and on the note were these words, "The Pentagon has been bombed." Well, I thought maybe he didn't know about the World Trade Center. They'd been in session all morning. I said, no, Chief, it's the World Trade Center in New York. He said, no, Howard, it's the Pentagon here. I'll never forget that. I handed the note back to him. I'm still sick. I didn't keep that note. I'm sure he threw it in the wastebasket, but I'll always remember that.
Well, we're going to hear from some musicians in just a second, and I know that you also were co-sponsored a bill that would allow, I think it was a Sonny Bono bill, that allowed for artists, musicians to extend the copyright on their work, right?
And what a great guy he was. Died in a ski accident, you may remember.
I do. Congressman, thank you so much for your service. What a great pleasure. Congressman Howard Coble, what a pleasure.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you all.
Congressman Howard Coble has served North Carolina's 6th Congressional District for 30 years. He's going to be retiring in January. Just ahead, we're going to talk to the founder of Scuppernong Books here in Greensboro, How to Make a Place a Place. First, we're going to hear music from Little Mountain. Stay with us.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you all. 5, 6.
I'm down on my luck, but I'm high on my hopes. I'm racing down mountains and sliding up slopes. What matters the most is not reaching the top. It's having momentum that no one can stop. A new kind of feeling, a new kind of start. I've opened my mind and I've opened my heart. I've got this ambition, I'm making it clear. It's all gonna happen in this new year. Used to believe that if all left to luck, I'd either be rich or die without a buck. The life I imagined, it, the life that I got, it's worse and it's better than I ever thought. So I got a few words that I just gotta say. There's good and there's bad and they're both on the way. And sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's not. You just gotta keep going, you can't ever stop. Don't drag your cold boots in the snow. Don't let your heart ever beat slow. You've got friends that you don't even know. You've got so many places to go. Don't drag your cold boots in the snow. Don't let your heart ever beat slow. You've got friends that you don't even know. You've got so many places to go. So many places to go.